Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Loopcast. Today, I'm very excited to have Dr. Nathan Brown on the line today, and he is a professor of political science and international affairs at George Washington University and also a non-resident senior associate in the Middle East program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. So thank you for coming on the show, Dr. Brown.
Thank you very much for having me.
Today we are going to be talking about a really interesting topic. We're going to be focusing on Egypt, and we're going to look at the likely trends and the roles and forms of modern and Islamic law in Egypt. So for those that might be following Egypt or know little bits about it, of course, since the revolution in 2011, Egypt has been going through this huge change in many, many ways within the culture, within the society, within the government. We have an interim government at the moment, and legal system as well. And there's been a lot of trials that have been popping up into mainstream news in Egypt. Some of them, for those who might be, once again, following the region, there's been the trials for journalists. Al Jazeera journalist is one that pops up a lot. And we've also had another trial recently, the Al Minya trial, which we might touch on a little bit later in this topic. But let's just, once again, welcome to the show, Dr. Brown. And why don't we just start out with talking about what are the roots of contemporary law in Egypt? And let's look at both modern law and Islamic law.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, the current Egyptian legal system, I think, probably should be traced back to the 19th century, when there was an attempt to bring in a centralized legal system. And it was essentially based on the French model. A civil law model, and both in the content of the law, the law that's written, the codes and so on, and in terms of the basic structure of the courts. If you take a look at Egyptian laws, if you take a look at Egyptian courts, you'll sometimes find direct translations from the French. And I've often said that if you want to understand the Egyptian legal system, it'd probably make more sense to spend time in a 19th century law school in France than it would to go to Al-Azhar, the chief seat of Islamic learning in the country. There is some Islamic influence on the legal system. It's at its height in the area of personal status law, that's marriage, divorce, and inheritance. And there are other ways in which Egyptian legislators have tried to draw on the Islamic legal heritage in writing and codifying Egyptian law. But I think it's essentially best seen as a civil law system on the French model, with some additional elements introduced, Islamic, and I would also say some authoritarian elements introduced as well.
So going back to the revolution in 2011, have the roots changed since this revolution? Like the roots of law, have they changed drastically, or has it been a slow change, or has there been no change?
I'd say very, very little change. I mean, obviously, there's been one big change in that Egypt's constitution has changed. You had some series of interim constitutions, and then you had the 2012 constitution written under the Muslim Brotherhood. You have the 2014 constitution, which was just approved by voters earlier this year. So you have some change at the constitutional level. But at the legal level, you actually don't have that much, certainly nothing fundamental. Egypt has not had a functioning parliament really for the entire period since the 2011 uprising. And so almost all legislation that exists has been ad hoc, issued by decree, by the president, by the military, and not in any way that fundamentally questions the basis of the legal system. In those constitutions that have changed over the, you had the interim constitutions and then the two supposedly permanent constitutions in 2012 and 2014, there were suggestions that Egyptian law might go in a different direction, but there hasn't been any time to see whether or not it would actually move in those directions. Under the 2012 constitution, there were probably stronger elements suggesting a move in an Islamic direction, but those were very vague, and we never found out how they would have been implemented. In the 2014 constitution, there are some suggestions of greater liberalism in some areas and greater interest in international human rights protections in some areas, but those we haven't really seen any effect of. And there are also some ways, I would say, in that in what in that the 2014 constitution actually deepens the potential for authoritarianism. But again, we haven't really seen how that will develop.
So let's go back to Al-Azhar. So how has Al-Azhar changed post-Arab Spring?
Well,
and why don't we, with that question, why don't we look at a basic overview of that, plus the power structure, as well as its influence among the people and the state?
Certainly, yeah. Al-Azhar is really a massive institution that is part of the Egyptian state, but it has some autonomy from it. Al-Azhar is first and foremost responsible for Islamic education in the country, or an awful lot of Islamic education in the country. It runs its own network of primary and secondary schools. It has a very large university, one of the largest universities in the country, that has both secular and religious faculties. Al-Azhar also has a collection of research institutes associated with it. It has mechanisms for giving interpretations of Islamic law, that is fatwas, and it has a very, very strong moral voice. The Sheikh of Al-Azhar, the leader of the institution, you could say really is the chief Islamic legal official in the country. And it has his opinions carry considerable political and moral weight. In terms of what's happened since 2011, I think there have been some very interesting developments. One of the ones that happened that didn't get enough attention, I think, right away, came at the very beginning of 2012, when the military, when it had full legislative authority, issued a new law for the government of Al-Azhar. And what that law did was to take the sheikh, who had been before a direct presidential appointment, and make him appointed by a body of senior scholars, 40 senior scholars associated with Al-Azhar, who would appoint the sheikh. And who were those 40 senior scholars? Well, the current sheikh gets to choose them. So what it did was set up this self-perpetuating structure at the top of Al-Azhar that really gave it an awful lot more potential autonomy from the Egyptian state. So that's one big change. A second change, I think, has been to, you could say, with that same legal amendment, what a second change has been to take Al-Azhar, or the leadership of Al-Azhar, and to some extent, I think, isolated a little bit from the rest of the institution. Those 40 people in the body of senior scholars, actually, they're not quite 40 yet because they haven't all been named, but those people, plus the sheikh, also the president of the university and some senior officials, are sometimes seen within the institution of Al-Azhar as operating as a little bit of a remove from the institution as a whole. And so there's a little bit of a gap within Al-Azhar between the student body, the faculty, and some of the scholars associated with it, and the leadership. The third effect has been, I think, to heighten the political importance of Al-Azhar. On July 3rd, when General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi announced that Morsi had been deposed as president, and also announced that the constitution had been suspended and so on, he did so in a press statement at which the Sheikh of Al-Azhar was present on the podium. So he seemed to be, what he basically seemed to be saying, is that Sheikh Al-Azhar seemed to be doing was lending the institution's prestige to the new political order in the country.
And how has this gone over with the people of Egypt? Because at first it seemed like Sisi had a good amount of support from the Egyptian people, but lately there seems to be more disgruntled feelings towards him, especially with the way he's presented running for presidency and so forth. So how has this influenced Al-Azhar with the general populace of Egypt?
Well, it's hard to tell. I mean, Egypt is a country of 85 million people, and it's also a deeply divided society. So it's hard to speak for the society as a whole. I think, you know, Al-Azhar's prestige as an institution is still fairly strong. At the same time, as I say, events since over the last year have done have been to associate the leadership of Al-Azhar with the new political system. And I think there's some nervousness in the religious establishment about that. Even to some extent, the Sheikh Al-Azhar himself seems to have, to some extent, backed away from playing the kind of strong political role that he seemed to be playing back in July. So there seems to be some kind of recognition that the more Al-Azhar gets involved in day-to-day politics, the more quickly it spends whatever political capital it has. And there's also another important political role for Al-Azhar right now, and that is not so much as a voice, but as a battleground. The campus of Al-Azhar has a student body which is probably more Islamist and more inclined to the Brotherhood than other parts of Egyptian society. So it's been a site of ongoing demonstrations, disruptions in studies, and so on. So the kind of polarization that you hear about in Egyptian society is particularly acute when it comes to Al-Azhar and Al-Azhar campuses.
And looking at this connection with the more devout of Egypt, and so like you said, more Islamist followers as well as Muslim Brotherhood followers, has there been a rub with the Egyptian security forces on this end? I mean, we saw how many Muslim Brotherhood members are being rounded up almost by default for being part of the Muslim Brotherhood. You know, there's this before or after 2011 and Morsi coming into power, Muslim Brotherhood almost was all of a sudden thrown into the political scene more than it had been and welcomed. And now it's sort of taken that 360 it's taken a 360 in the sense of being almost outcast a lot, and interim government is very much cracking down on it. So how has Al-Azhar mediated this?
Well, it hasn't mediated it very well at all, and I think that's kind of part of the problem for the institution. The fact is that almost all institutions in the Egyptian state are being hotly contested right now, and in a sense, forced to decide which side that they're on. And for an institution like Al-Azhar, which seems to have a feet firmly planted in the camp, I would say kind of the Egyptian state, but another foot, firmly planted in the camp of trying to make the society more Islamic, that's really been a problem for the institution. And you see that in just the way that I think the institution is just very, very badly divided, and the way in which it's been very, very disruptive. Even for, you know, something as mundane as going to class at the Al-Azhar campus.
So what are the likely roles that Al-Azhar might be taking in this new environment then?
Well, I think it's clear what the role that the Sheikh and the top leadership of Al-Azhar would like. And that would be, say, to have kind of a strong moral force, but not necessarily be involved in day-to-day politics, or to have a strong authoritative role. I mean, the attitude, I like to say, of the top leadership of Al-Azhar is to say something like, you know, as all Sunni Muslims are encouraged to develop their own interpretation, no Sunni Muslim can tell another Sunni Muslim what to say, what to believe, what to do. So they're all responsible for coming up to the right answer to religious questions. And if you want to know the right answer, ask us, because we know. So it's this kind of combination of disavowing any formal legal authority whilst also claiming an extremely strong a moral authority. So that's one part of, I think, the Sheikh's vision. The other part of the Sheikh's vision might be referred to as, or they like to refer to as, the wasati, the centrist approach. And it's really an approach that says that there are all these different interpretations of Islam out there, of Islamic law out there, and the one that is most appropriate is the one that facilitates people's interests in their social relations and so on. Islamic law was sent in order to make things easier for human beings, not harder for them. So in some ways, the Al-Azhar approach, and one championed by the Sheikh, would be almost the precise opposite of that of Salafis. Salafis who insist on literal interpretation of the text no matter where it leads them. And what the Al-Azhar approach, the dominant Al-Azhar approach, would be to say, no, you don't, you really have to understand how Islamic law is to be applied, taking into account prevailing social, economic, and political conditions. So it has to be understood in context. So that's the approach of El-Azhar as a whole, and I would say it has, in general, some broad resonance within the institution. There are some Salafis within El-Azhar in the lower ranks. There are some who have other kinds of orientations, but it's still the dominant approach. Some people think that the Sheikh of El-Azhar perhaps goes too far, sometimes a little bit too liberal as in interpretations, and some people think he's too closely identified with the current regime and too quick to get involved in politics and too doesn't do a good enough job of distancing himself from it.
And staying on Al-Azhar for one more question, what areas do you think it might gain or lose influence in this environment in Egypt at the moment?
I think that I think it has gained influence short term, without question. And the Sheikh of El-Azhar is now a major figure in Egyptian public life, and I would say more of an independent figure than he was in the past. But and I would also say within the Islamic religious establishment, he's more central as well. Other high officials, like the Minister of Religious Affairs or the Mufti, the official who's responsible for delivering some interpretation of Islamic law for the Egyptian state, these people are in his camp. So the current Sheikh al-Azhar is very central, short term. The real question is whether that centrality will come back to haunt him, whether, the analogy I might have would be, say, to the role of the U.S. Supreme Court after Bush versus Gore. It decided the outcome of the 2000 presidential election, but sacrificed a considerable amount of its prestige and its reputation for nonpartisanship by so doing. And El-Azhar may have made the same mistake by getting so involved in politics since 2011.
Interesting. So let's shift now to what I call the two justice systems in Egypt. So we have this city versus what you could call rural or tribal. Why don't we look at this, like these two systems that are working in Egypt?
Sure. I mean, I would say that in many societies in the Middle East, you do have a collection of legal mechanisms that depend on custom, arbitration, mediation, tribal norms, and so on. They're actually weaker in Egypt than in almost any other society in the region. The formal state system is much, much stronger, simply because the state is so highly centralized, and the system is so deep, the state system, the official system, is so deeply rooted. However, there are important pockets of Egyptian society that where you still have some role for tribal justice, for informal mediation, and that sort of thing. You have it to some extent in Upper Egypt, in rural Egypt south of Cairo, where you still have some kind of role for this. And even if you have a formal legal dispute, say, between two individuals, it's often necessary to involve the larger families in some kind of dispute settlement mechanism that goes outside of official channels. So that's in Upper Egypt, and also in Sinai, where the Egyptian state and its courts are viewed, I think, as an external, alien, sometimes repressive body, and therefore there's been an attempt by some of the population within Sinai to develop its own mechanisms outside of the formal state structure.
So why don't we now look at Egypt's judiciary system? So I like to say that during the Nasser era, Nasser had this idea of setting up, I think one of your articles mentioned it as kangaroo courts, which is a really good term for it. But it seems like in Egypt today that there really isn't a need for that at the moment. There's like all the Egyptian instruments of the government seem to be on board to just sort of join in on these courts and these cases. And there's also some non-governmental organizations that seem to also be on board with what has been going on in the legal system lately. So I was wondering if we could look at that a bit.
Certainly, yeah. You know, you look back at the last time Egypt has had things called revolutions. Those were in 1952 when the military overthrew sort of this parliamentary monarchy. And then in 1971, Anwar Sadat had what he called a corrective revolution, which really was sort of a rearrangement of the regime that was created in 1952. On both those occasions, what the leadership of Egypt did was to say, there's certain things that are going on that, and certain political forces, Muslim Brotherhood, political opposition, opponents even within the regime, that we need to repress. But we can't use the formal legal system. It's too slow. Maybe there's no laws that they violated. You know, Nasser, when he was towards the end of his presidency, he was president of Egypt until his death in 1970. Sometime in 1969, he was supposed to have given a speech to some judges in which he said to them, you know, look, you should thank me. I did whatever I had to do, and I never involved you in it. If I had to arrest somebody, throw somebody in jail, I set up a special court. I didn't demand, I didn't pass repressive laws and make you do my dirty work for me. That was kind of the attitude of that regime. And even in the Mubarak period, when you had, I think, a greater observance of legal procedure, there was still a set of, you could say, special courts. There were state security courts, there were military courts that were, there were ways in which security forces could detain you. There were ways that they could basically avoid the formal legal system. That doesn't mean the formal legal system was perfect or that it didn't have authoritarian elements, but what it meant was that when Egypt's rulers wanted to act their most, in the most harsh and repressive manner, they generally had ways of going outside the courts. Now, since 2011, that's been more difficult to do. It's been more difficult to do partly because there's been such an outcry against special courts, military courts, and so on. They've been used, but there's been an awful lot more pushback. In addition, there's been an expiration of the state of emergency, which made some of those things possible, so that Egypt's rulers have basically been forced to rely on the regular court system. So how has the regular court system reacted? Well, what happened in 2011 was that, like a lot of state institutions, they were just kind of caught and confused, didn't know how to react. With the election of President Morsi in June of 2012, there's indications of nervousness on the part of the judiciary and a feeling that the Muslim Brotherhood might be out to get them. And by the end of 2012, there's a real feeling on both sides, on the side of the presidency, on the side of a lot of the judiciary, that there's a battle brewing there. The judiciary thinks that Morsi and the presidency is out to get them, and Morsi and the presidency think there are important elements of the judiciary that are in league with what they see as a deep state, one that is resistant to brotherhood rule. And so that enmity really began to set in. I think that by when Morsi was overthrown on July 3rd, there was relief on the part of the vast majority of Egyptian judges. Morsi did have supporters within the judiciary, but a lot of those people have been have found their careers dead-ending when Morsi was overthrown in July. So the judiciary as a whole, I think, is fully on board with the new political order. Even, as you say, some human rights organizations, some NGOs that were very active in pressing for reform and for greater respect for human rights before 2011 are on board as well. The most breathtaking example of that was a report issued by the Ibn Khaldun Center. The center is founded by Saladin Ibrahim, really one of the earliest and most forceful research institutes and advocates for, I think, a liberal vision for Egypt. That institute, the Ibn Khaldun Center, issued a report right after the suppression of demonstrations in Rabaa Adawiyah this past August, where something like 1,000 people were killed. They issued a report basically endorsing what had happened. So you have this, I think, what I would refer to as almost a hysterical atmosphere among parts of Egyptian society, and parts of the judiciary are, I think, part of that. They're very much on board with the new repression. Other parts of the judiciary, I think, are a little bit more reticent. They still may be supportive of the new order, but they may be a little bit embarrassed by some of the more extreme measures that have been taken.
And, I mean, what would be the roots of this willingness to be on board to basically repression. I mean, there are a lot of instances that you see these statements made, and you made an example earlier in the talk. And, I mean, for someone in the Western world, we sit here and we go, wait a minute, that doesn't sound like real law. So what would be the roots of this willing to be on board towards repressing its own people?
Yeah, I sometimes say that the atmosphere in Egypt is a little bit like the United States on September 12th, 2001. Or you could say during the McCarthy period. If you take a look at those periods, I mean, courts in very few societies really can stand up to such an overheated political atmosphere. It's not necessarily just that they are doing the bidding of the rulers of the society. There's this atmosphere in public opinion, in the media. You know, you turn on the television, you see this this steady drumbeat that says, you know, Egypt is under assault. There's this foreign body, the Muslim Brotherhood, that's backed by Israel, Iran, Qatar, and the United States, that has been trying to take over the country. And there's this, you know, fifth column. There's these people who are threatening the country from within. Very few judiciaries could stand up to an atmosphere like that. So that's why I think the judiciary has, parts of the judiciary have been sort of permitting what's happened. Some go beyond permitting, and some go beyond that to actually participating in it. And again, I think those are elements of the judiciary that see the Egyptian state really as the ultimate guarantor of order in the society, order and justice within the society, and they see that state as having been momentarily occupied or invaded by this alien and hostile political force, the Muslim Brotherhood, and now is the time to fight back hard rather than show weakness in the face of that kind of threat.
And I want to look at the roots of the judiciary system right now. You wrote a fantastic article. I'm pretty sure the title was "Judges Say the Darndest Things," and it was really like a nice outline. And one of the things you mentioned is that the judiciary is basically a product of historical evolution. And I was wondering if you could elaborate on that for our listeners.
Yeah, I mean, what I meant was it's a little bit of a sort of an abstract or academic point, but people look at a regime like Egypt. And they say, look, this is an authoritarian system. It's always been authoritarian. What are you talking about, judicial independence, role for the judiciary? In a place like this, it's not a liberal democracy. There's no place for the rule of law. And I say, well, yes, there is some truth to that. But if you take a look at the Egyptian judiciary, even though it's operating in an authoritarian context, it does have some strong institutional roots of its own, and it does have some ability to operate a little bit autonomously. So it's not necessarily directly a puppet on the strings of whoever is ruling the country. It's its own institution, and it's evolved in its own way. That's particularly the case in Egypt, where the judiciary has not simply a strong institutional tradition, but even a strong family tradition. That is to say, it's very common to run into a judge whose father was a judge, whose uncle's a judge, grandfather was a judge, and so on. So there's this very strong sense of corporate identity. And that allows them I should also say there's other parts as well. Most judges, when they issue decisions, do so as part of multi-judge panels. So they're almost always being forced to interact with their colleagues. There's liberal rights of appeal, which means that any time you write an opinion, even as a multi-judge panel, it may be reviewed by other judges. So that really creates these sort of strong internal bonds. And the judiciary, therefore, is this institution that has developed a little bit on its own and is able to articulate its voice. It's a voice that is, I think, very supportive of the Egyptian state, but it gets a little bit antsy and even resentful when it is being asked to do the bidding of specific rulers. And that was, in a sense, a lot of the feeling in the Mubarak regime on the part of some judges who said, look, we're part of the Egyptian state. We don't mind upholding, you know, the law in Egypt. But when the Minister of Justice or the President starts telling us what to do or seems to want us to do specific things in specific cases, that's when we push back.
Interesting. And so, building on that, I would like to take this talk towards the Al-Minya trial, which, with what you just said, and, you know, courts having some autonomy from the actual government, you know, we have this trial that got a lot of bad publicity because basically 529 individuals were sentenced to death in this mass death sentence. And I mean, the reason why there are sit-ins and protests and some violence ensued, and I think there was a death of one policeman, and, you know, for people to see this mass death sentence of so many people all at once, how can that happen in a legal system?
Well, there are, I should say, I mean, the verdict is absolutely stunning. And it's a mark of, I think, how badly things have gone awry in Egyptian justice. I should say that there are two legal aspects that lessen that, probably the horror of the verdict, that aren't immediately apparent. One aspect is that an Egyptian court in a case like that tends to try an entire case, rather than having each individual get a specific trial. So the fact that you had 529 people on trial sounds ridiculous if you look at it from the perspective of a common law court, which has usually a discrete trial, maybe for a small group of individuals, but to try 529 people would never be done here. It is done in Egypt. The second thing is that when people do not show up when for a criminal trial, what tends to happen is that they are convicted and given the maximum sentence, but with the right, an automatic appeal if they actually show up. So of those 529 people, I think something like 350 or 400 were tried in absentia, which means if they do show up, the sentence will be set aside and they will get their own individual trial. So those are the things that kind of lessen it, that explain some of the 529 sentences. Those explanatory notes aside, it's still, as I say, a stunning verdict. There were people who, among those 529 who were convicted and sentenced to death, who were already dead at the time the crime was committed. So there's certainly something wrong there. Even with those legal niceties aside, the court clearly went haywire in trying to sentence people who had basically an ironclad alibi because they were dead. The trial was lightning quick, there was no real attempt to review the evidence, and so on. And so what I think you see there is a couple things going wrong. Number one, you have a court that is part of this hysterical atmosphere, and that's what gets so many people's attention. There's something else that went wrong as well that got a little bit less attention, and that is the public prosecution. The public prosecution is a judicial function in Egypt. And people who bring cases to court, criminal cases to court, are judicial, and they see their job as not necessarily, you know, being an advocate against a specific a person accused. It's not an adversarial system like you would have here, but they see themselves as advocates of the interests of the state and the society, and they have some degree of professionalism. What has happened since the coup last July is that the public prosecution seems to have gone completely over to the intelligence services and to believe even the most outlandish things that the intelligence services feed them. So that rather than being a filter to take whatever the police and the security services dream up, they're a megaphone. And so they brought, you know, the 529 people without serious evidence against this, against a large number of them, to trial. So with the courts breaking down, or at least some judges sort of succumbing to this kind of pressure, with the prosecution acting as a conduit for the most outlandish charges, the Egyptian judicial system, I think right now, is probably got to be seen as broken.
And I mean, what do you think is the likelihood that these, well, out of the 529 individuals that are actually alive at this time, let's like put aside the ones that were already dead when this verdict was announced. So out of these living individuals, what are the chances that they really are going to be put to death? I mean, there's been a huge, of course, international outcry and talks about how this goes against UN law, international law. So in your opinion, what is the likelihood of this?
I think very few. Egyptian death sentences are rarely carried out. They're reversed on appeal. The Mufti is supposed to review them. He can send them back for reconsideration, retrial. And so there's all kinds of procedural steps that have to be taken between the 529 sentences and the actual execution. And the historic pattern in these cases in Egypt is that those procedural steps often result in an overturning or a lightening of the sentence. I think in this particular case, the verdict is such an embarrassment internationally and to some extent even domestically, that there's going to be, that the judiciary is going to feel some pressure to find some way out of implementing these sentences. So I would guess of the 529, they'll go through an absolutely horrible period of having this death sentence hanging over them, but I would guess that very few, if any, will be actually executed.
And on the point of this being a bad example of Egyptian law, almost not a laughing stock, but a case that has gone all this attention and very bad negative attention, do you think there's a likelihood of other cases that show similar turns of events, or do you think that this is sort of going to be an example for the Egyptian courts to not go down that road again?
Well, there have been a few courts that have gone down this kind of road. I mean, the case before this that got a little bit less international attention, but still some, but a lot of attention in Egypt, was a group of girls in Alexandria who were given very, very harsh sentences, basically for a fairly innocuous political demonstration of, you know, flashing a sign that was supportive of the Muslim Brotherhood. And they were given multi-year prison sentences. I can't remember exactly how long. Those sentences were reversed on appeal. There have been other places like this where the courts have, I would say, in a sense, lost their mind. I think with the regularization of the political situation in Egypt, those are going to become a little bit less frequent. But you still have an awful lot of cases that are winding their way through the courts, where you have prosecution sometimes for outlandish reasons. You know, you've got one of the, President Morsi is on trial right now for a couple things, including espionage, he's charged when he was president of sharing intelligence information with foreign powers, especially with Hamas. And if you think about this for a second, I mean, if there's one official in the state apparatus who would be authorized to share intelligence information, it should be the president. So the charge just makes no sense. He's also on charge for some kind of outlandish plot involving Hamas, Hezbollah, Iran, and so on, in escaping from Egyptian prison back in January 2011. There's all kinds of weird cases. And what's remarkable about these cases is that they not only finger the top leadership of the Brotherhood, but sometimes you've got dozens of people, some of whom have zero connection with the case, who are just kind of thrown in. So there's still a lot of those cases that just have gotten an awful lot less attention that are still winding their way through the courts.
So I want to take this talk before we wrap up the talk. I want to take it towards more of the Islamic side of law. And I'd like to talk about fiqh, which for our listeners who might not know the roots of Islamic law, fiqh is basically Islamic jurisprudence. It's an expression of the code of conduct, so Sharia, that's detailed in the Quran. And I want to look at fiqh, and I would like to see how fiqh might be used as gap fillers in courts, and if so, in which courts?
Yeah, it's a great question, and the answer varies a lot from society to society within the Muslim world. In Egypt, what I would say is that when you get to the actual legal system, for the most part, fiqh doesn't play a direct role, with one exception, which I'll get to in a second. But the reason is this. Fiqh, Islamic jurisprudence, is a dialogue among scholars. It's scholars who are trying to take a look at religious sources, the Quran, Hadith, the sayings, and the actions of the Prophet Muhammad and the early community, and they're trying to interpret it in the light of some specific kind of schools of thought and ways of interpreting those texts to come up with an answer to a particular legal question. So that's what fiqh is. you take a look at the Egyptian state, the modern Egyptian state, with its strong centralization, its mania for kind of uniformity, for knowing what is law and what isn't law, this sort of thing, and you tell that Egyptian state, wait, we've got this intellectual tradition, the response is of state bodies to say, kind of tell us what the law is and tell us what it isn't. Don't tell us to like engage, you know, ask a bunch of scholars and have a seminar. We want to know, is this legal or is it not? So that's kind of the, you went again with a strong and very legalistic state in Egypt. Fiqh doesn't directly impact the way that the courts apply law. The exception, as I say, is that under the Egyptian civil code, when it is the case that the legislative text is ambiguous, Islamic jurisprudence and Islamic law is one of the things that courts can look to. So they can look to it as a way of trying to understand what the black letter law means in a particular case. Judges in these courts are not trained in Islamic jurisprudence, so although they're given that license, very few actually do it. They've got a little bit of an opening, but they don't use it. Now, that's not to say that fiqh plays a role in Egyptian law. It does play a role, and it plays a role when it comes time for the parliament to make law, when it comes time for legislation to be drafted. There's sometimes an effort to consult Islamic legal sources and Islamic legal authorities, the Sheikh of Al-Azhar, the Mufti, and so on. And there's an article in the Egyptian constitution that says the principles of Islamic law shall be the main source of legislation. And that has sometimes been used to try and bring Egyptian law, black letter law, into line with traditional Islamic jurisprudence. So there are ways in which Islamic legal heritage does inform the content of Egyptian law. But generally, when a court wants to make a decision, it really wants to know kind of not what is this broad intellectual tradition, but what is the law that's actually hard, you know, black and white, printed on the books, legislated by the parliament or decreed by some relevant official in Egypt.
Well, I want to once again thank you for coming on the show. And we still have a little bit of time, and what we like to do is give our guests a moment to maybe touch on something important that we might have not have touched on in the talk already, or if there's something else on your mind that you want to add to the talk. So I'm just going to leave this open to you and give you that moment.
Well, thank you very much. It's a brave thing on your part to give a microphone to an academic and say, talk about whatever you want for as long as you like. But I'll try to be disciplined. I guess one thing that I would say is something that I referred to a couple times when we were speaking, and that is that there's actually tremendous variety within the Arab world. Egypt is at one extreme, I think, in terms of how centralized its legal system is, how powerful its legal system is, how centralized the state is, how deeply institutionalized it is, and so on. So what goes for Egypt doesn't necessarily go for Saudi Arabia, for Yemen, and so on. There's tremendous variety within the Arab world and within the broader Islamic world. In most societies with a Muslim majority population, there's some way in which religion and the way people understand religion deeply informs the way that people operate in law and in politics. But the Egyptian case is influential in some other countries. Some other countries watch what Egypt does, but it's also very much, I would say, kind of at one extreme of the spectrum in terms of its centralization and institutionalization, also the degree to which an authoritarian regime, what is still an authoritarian regime, is still very legalistic in nature. And the second point, I'll try to make it even briefer, is to say that even though the Egyptian regime is legalistic, the content of that law, if you take a look at Egyptian law in important areas, like, for instance, a new right of a law on public demonstrations that was promulgated earlier this year, or late last year, it's a law that is extremely vaguely worded. So it's the legal system in Egypt is grown up in an authoritarian context, and that means that the content of law is potentially extremely authoritarian. It means that whenever an Egyptian does anything, they're in potential violation of the law. And that gives tremendous discretion to legal and judicial authorities, to the prosecution, to the security services, and so on. to implement law in an authoritarian manner. So to say that the Egypt is a legalistic place is not to say that it isn't authoritarian. It's both legalistic and authoritarian at the same time.
Well, thank you once again so much for coming on the show. And for our listeners, Dr. Brown has a number of very, very in-depth, insightful books. So if you're interested in learning more about this topic or other topics around Egyptian law, you know, please look for his books. And just thank you so much for coming on the show and lending your wonderful thoughts on this topic.
Thank you so much for having me.